Today is Monday, April 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Britain's Boris Johnson returns to work Monday after recovering from COVID-19.
The biggest single challenge this country has faced.
Plus, the pandemic's effect on global vaccine programs.
We will have, in the next 6 months, in the next 1 year, what I would call a bad cohort of children that may not be protected from measles.
And why it's important to be wary of reports coming out of North Korea. Those stories and more are next. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is back at work after recovering from COVID-19.
Every day, I know that this virus brings new sadness and mourning to households across the land. And it is still true that this is the biggest single challenge this country has faced since the war. And I in no way minimize the continuing problems we face. And yet it is also true that we are making progress with fewer hospital admissions, fewer COVID patients in ICU, and real signs now that we are passing through the peak.
Johnson was speaking a month and a day after he tested positive for the coronavirus. The United Kingdom is one of the worst hit nations, with more than 20,732 hospital deaths reported as of Saturday. Globally, there have been at least 2,981,000 confirmed cases and over 206,000 deaths, according to a Johns Hopkins University tracker. On the economic front, Asian stock markets are higher after Japan's central bank promised to buy more assets to shore up financial markets and more governments prepared to revive struggling economies by reopening businesses. Elsewhere, the U.S. Federal Reserve is more likely to announce that it will wait to see the impact of earlier stimulus before taking more action, as the European Central Bank says it will likely keep its options for easing open. The AP's Shelley Adler has more on what may be facing the U.S. economy in the days and months ahead.
The White House is bracing for some tough economic numbers.
The next couple of months are going to look terrible.
White House advisor Kevin Hassett.
You're going to see numbers that are as bad as anything that we've ever seen. I think the unemployment rate is going to jump to a level probably around 16% or even higher in the next jobs report.
And what about gross domestic product, a common indicator used to track the health of a nation's economy?
I think GDP growth in the second quarter is going to be, you know, negative. Big number. Wall Street estimates are 20, negative 30% at an annual rate.
The next jobs report is due out on May 8th. I'm Shelley Adler.
More than a million Australians have downloaded a coronavirus contact tracing app within hours of it being released by the government. Officials have said the technology would help Australia get back to normal and help lift restrictions. But it has been criticized by civil liberty groups. Phil Mercer reports that while Australia has managed to control its coronavirus outbreak, officials worry about the risk of another flare-up.
It's vital to know quickly if you've come in contact with someone who has tested positive for coronavirus. It's why we've introduced the COVID Safe app.
The Australian government says the voluntary app will help to save lives. It's designed to enable health officials to trace people potentially exposed to COVID-19. Smartphone users who download the app will be notified if they've had contact with another user who's tested positive for coronavirus. It uses Bluetooth signals to log when people have been close to one another. Officials believe it could help to trace undiagnosed COVID-19 infections. They've insisted the data will only be used by state health authorities. Australia's chief medical officer is Brendan Murphy.
No Australian should have any concerns about downloading this app. It is only for one purpose, to help contact tracing if someone becomes positive. I think Australians will rise to the challenge because they have risen to the challenge of distancing, they've risen to the challenge of testing.
The COVID Safe app is based on software used in Singapore, but civil liberties campaigners say it's an invasion of privacy. Pauline Wright from the Law Council of Australia says data protection safeguards are needed.
If there are problems, then people need to have the assurance that it will be overseen by an independent authority.
The government wants at least 40% of Australians, roughly 10 million people, to sign up to make the COVID-19 digital tracking measure effective. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
As the coronavirus pandemic rages on worldwide, its disruptions are extending to vaccine campaigns in many parts of the world's least developed countries. In an interview with VOA's Mariama Diallo, a major vaccine organization says that while it's important to respond to the current pandemic, it's crucial for countries to keep an eye on other immunization efforts, especially with an ongoing pandemic.
Recent study by Gavi, a global vaccine alliance, estimates COVID-19 will cause more than 13 million people to miss out on vaccinations against measles, meningitis, polio, and yellow fever, among other infectious and often deadly diseases.
Pakistan, we have had to hold back on some programs because of the lockdown and the inability for people to move. A good number of other countries in West Africa, Burkina Faso, Chad, Zimbabwe. So there's a whole list of countries that will be impacted.
But Tabani Maposa, Gavi's managing director of country programs, tells VOA that not all vaccine campaigns have stopped. For example, the Democratic Republic of Congo is continuing its routine immunizations against measles while the country deals with other pathogens.
The reason they chose to go ahead with measles campaign is because they really learned a big lesson with the Ebola, that measles was actually killing more children than Ebola was actually killing people.
Measles outbreaks are currently ongoing in several countries, including DRC, which has recorded more than 300,000 cases and 6,000 deaths, mostly children under the age of 5, according to UNICEF. At a northern DRC hospital, Doctors Without Borders has treated patients in a measles isolation ward.
So here we can see a typical rashes coming from measles. Here in the skin we can see the tigroid appearance, typical of the recovery phase of the measles.
But with COVID-19 spreading across the developing world, it's likely that more immunization programs will be suspended, risking a resurgence of vaccine-preventable diseases, according to health experts.
We will have, in the next 6 months, in the next 1 year, what I would call a bad cohort of children that may not be protected from measles, that may not be protected from pertussis, and other diseases that really have high morbidity and mortality.
Some wonder whether it's more important to prevent exposure to the coronavirus or to lower the risk of contracting other diseases.
What is important is for what we need are health workers that are able to deliver that routine immunization. But if those health workers are not protected from COVID, then there is no routine immunization. But also how we protect the broader population and contain COVID.
Immunization campaigns faced challenges long before COVID-19 emerged.
There is always going to be somebody who's uninformed, but there is also going to be somebody who really does not believe in vaccines. Our role is to speak the truth of vaccines and what they do.
Maposa says communities must understand the enduring benefits of vaccinations, even as they battle COVID-19. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
The COVID-19 pandemic has affected daily life for most people on the planet. Although for now, the greatest number of people who are sick or dying of the disease are in the United States, especially New York. Africa is preparing for a devastating onslaught of the disease, for which it is poorly prepared. Now, to find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with John Campbell, the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington and a former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria via Zoom.
The disease has now been identified as present in virtually every country in sub-Saharan Africa. The numbers that are infected are fundamentally unknown because the testing capacity is so low.
As it is here, right?
Well, much lower than here. For example, South Africa is generally regarded as a hotspot, but the number of confirmed cases in South Africa is less than in Washington, D.C.
I know that the virus has already affected the political class in some countries, including in Nigeria, where you're very familiar from your term as ambassador there.
That's right. The chief of staff to the Nigerian president has died from the disease, and he was probably the second most powerful person in the country. A number of Nigerian governors are in quarantine, and a number are sick. Of those Africans who travel frequently, the disease is clearly present.
Are there official estimates in terms of the potential deaths in Africa from COVID-19?
The estimates from the UN are all over the place. The low estimate is 300,000 deaths. The high estimate is a bit more than 3 million if nothing is done to mitigate the impact.
How prepared is Africa at the present time?
Very little. Let me give you a specific example. If you take the number of intensive care units in Africa, it's about 5 for every 100,000 people. In Europe, it's 4,000 for every 100,000 people.
You said that there are several aggravating factors in Africa and some mitigating factors that might help cushion the blow.
Let's start with the fact that perhaps 70% of Africa's working population works in the informal economy. That means the work they do is face to face. They're not working in factories and they're not working in offices. This makes social distancing all but impossible. Let's take another fact. About half of Africa's population now lives in urban areas. About half, again, or a quarter altogether, live crammed into slums where facilities for hand washing are minimal and social distancing is simply impossible. African cities are poor. The people who live in them are poor. There's virtually no margin. There's no cushion.
The cities don't have access to the supplies they need, equipment and masks, etc.
And the bidding war that seems to be going on amongst various agencies of the developed world for those kinds of supplies is anything but edifying.
And the mitigating factors that might be helpful?
If half the population live in urban areas, half the population lives in rural areas, dispersed. Secondly, old people are not concentrated in Africa. They don't have nursing homes or retirement communities. Instead, typically what you will have is a multi-generational household. There'll be ancient granny, there'll be mother and father, there'll be children, there may be grandchildren, and they're all living in a family unit.
So you don't have the same sort of devastation you have in the U.S. and Europe, where entire nursing homes are ravaged with the virus?
No. And then finally, the African population is dramatically younger than the population of any other continent. And it would appear that COVID-19 most affects older people rather than younger people.
That was John Campbell at the Council on Foreign Relations and former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria. He was speaking to our own Adam Phillips. And coming up later...
Definitely, it is going to be different in the sense that we are unable to congregate, and this is what the mosque is made for, congregational activities, prayers, events, so on and so forth.
This is VOA News.
Make a difference by honoring ordinary people doing extraordinary things to help one another. VOA encourages you to tell us about everyday people who have shown leadership in your communities during the coronavirus crisis. Submit your nominations to VOA Leaders at voanews.com. Send us your name, phone number, and email, and a VOA reporter will contact you. We're all in this together.
This is Science in a Minute. A 2012 Harvard Medical School-led study linked grief over losing a close loved one, such as a spouse, child, or parent, with a higher risk of a heart attack, which some refer to as a broken heart. The study proposed that this risk increased to 21 times higher than normal within the first day of a loss, almost 6 times higher within the first week, but dropped steadily over the first month to about 6 months. A new Australian study suggests the combination of a beta-blocker blood pressure medication and an aspirin could reduce the risk of a bereavement-induced myocardial infarction. Lead author Jeffrey Toffler, a professor at the University of Sydney, says his team found that the medication used in a low dose once a day successfully reduced spikes in blood pressure and heart rate, as well as provided positive changes in blood clotting tendency, all contributing factors to a heart attack. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Satellite images reviewed by Washington-based Project 38 North, which monitors North Korean affairs, shows a special train, possibly belonging to North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, parked at one of the country's resort towns last week. Reuters' Gloria So has more.
The pictures were reviewed amid conflicting reports as to Kim's whereabouts as speculation simmers over his health. 38 North says that the train was parked at the, quote, leadership station in the city of Wonsan on April 21st and 23rd, which is reportedly reserved for the Kim family's use. Reuters has not been able to independently verify if the train belonged to Kim or if he himself was in Wonsan. But it backs up remarks from top officials in South Korea on Sunday. Top foreign policy adviser Moon Chung-in said Kim is alive and well and has stayed in Wonsan for weeks. Speculation about Kim's health first arose after his absence from one of the country's biggest yearly events, the birthday of his grandfather Kim Il-sung earlier this month. Since then, he's remained out of sight. Then last week, Seoul-based website Daily NK reported a source telling them Kim was recovering from a cardiovascular procedure. Since then, multiple South Korean media reports have cited unnamed sources that point to Kim staying in the Wonsan area. And on Friday, a South Korean source told Reuters their intelligence was that Kim was alive and would make an appearance soon. Reuters has also reported that China dispatched a team of medical experts to North Korea last week, according to three people familiar with the situation. However, it's not immediately clear what that trip may signal in terms of Kim's health. Reporting on North Korea is notoriously difficult due to tight information control, and experts caution that Kim has disappeared from his country's state media before. They last reported Kim's whereabouts when he presided over a meeting on April 11th. Kim vanished for over a month in 2014, and North Korean state TV later showed him walking with a limp.
Gloria So reports for Reuters News. A report by the UN mission in Afghanistan noted a drop in the number of civilians killed in violence in the first 3 months of this year compared to the same time last year, but underscore the still heavy toll the conflict continues to inflict on the civilian population. The report said 533 people, including 152 children, died due to the fighting in the war-torn country in the first quarter of 2020, and hundreds more were wounded. That represented a 29% decrease compared to the same period in 2019 and the lowest death toll figure for a first quarter of the year since 2012. The Syrian military and state media say Israeli warplanes flying over Lebanon have fired missiles toward areas near the Syrian capital of Damascus, killing 3 civilians and wounding 4 on Monday. The military says the country's air defenses shot down most of the missiles. Israel rarely confirms attacks and did not comment on the Syrian report. A Saudi-led coalition mired in the war in Yemen has urged Emirati-backed separatists to honor the terms of the Riyadh peace deal and return control of Aden to the country's internationally recognized government. The statement comes after the separatist Southern Transitional Council again claimed sole control on Sunday of Aden. Yemen's war has pushed the Arab world's poorest nation to the brink of famine and killed over 100,000 people. During the coronavirus pandemic, Islamic centers around the United States are shut down, and social distancing has become a real barrier for most of Ramadan's traditional rituals. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi spoke with Shakir El-Sayed, imam of the Dar al-Hijra Islamic Center in Virginia. He spoke about how this quarantine Ramadan will be different and how Muslim Americans are coping with it.
Definitely, it is going to be different in the sense that we are unable to congregate, and this is what the mosque is made for, congregational activities, prayers, events, so on and so forth. So what we are actually doing on the social service side, we are distributing the food about 2 hours before Maghrib. We used to feed about 800 people every day, or 1,000. This year, we are not going to stop. We are going to also offer the food, but people will not have a dining hall set up, and they will not congregate or eat together. They will come, there will be a drive-through delivery system. They will enter the gates, and they will be guided to a path. They will be delivered the food packages for them and their families. They will pick the food and exit the premises and go take their break and fast at home. For the educational activities, we are supplementing the Taraweeh prayer with Quran recitation. I will continue to host Q&A session over Zoom for the community, because in Ramadan, like all other times of the year, there are lots of questions that people want to have answers for, especially on fasting rules and so on and so forth. And we are hosting Quran recitation by Sheikh Abdel Fattah Abu Asi from Al-Azhar. And this will be done also over Zoom. So these are basically the daily activities. We are definitely encouraging people to pray at home with their family together and to spend some time reading the Quran. And this is something that it used to happen at the time of the life of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam.
Sheikh Shakir, Islamic centers used to prepare iftar meals for Muslims from all social levels. With a large number of unemployed people because of the coronavirus, is Dar al-Hijra planning to feed Muslims who lost their jobs in Ramadan?
Definitely, we have developed the database with families who are struggling with unemployment or low wages or inopportune times that we are going through. And we are planning to offer those meals, but it will be meals on wheels, if you will, whereby they will come, they will pick the meals within 2 hours before the breakfast. They will not be invited inside mosque with the dining hall preparations and everything as we used to do every Ramadan. This time it will be family meals together, and people will pick it from the masjid and take it home. But they need to connect with the social service to register for this, inshallah.
Part of Ramadan rituals is helping the poor. Did the pandemic increase your list of needy families?
Yes, it did. We have many more people than we used to. We used to serve about 250 families before Ramadan. Now the list is about 700.
Did you detect any increase of members' charity contributions this Ramadan with this pandemic problem?
Yes, we host a donation campaign on Saturdays for people to bring non-perishable foods. But for Ramadan, we are preparing beyond that hot meals ready to eat, and people pick it 2 hours before the iftar.
Muslim Americans used to learn more about their faith through special sessions during their Ramadan nightly prayers at Islamic centers. How would they get their spiritual dose with Islamic centers shut down now?
We will do this over Zoom and over the Facebook page, Twitter, and all social media outlets that Dar al-Hijra has established several years ago. So we are using those. People can follow us on Dar al-Hijra Facebook, on our website, on YouTube Live, and all our media outlets like Twitter, Snapchat, and other media outlets.
Shakir El-Sayed is the imam of the Dar al-Hijra Islamic Center, one of the largest in Virginia. He was speaking to VOA's own Mohammed El-Shenawi. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.